Hey guys, hope you're all doing well. Another fantastic guest today. Before I say hello to him, let me introduce him. Professor Jordan Peterson is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and a practicing clinical psychologist, author of over 100 academic scientific articles, Google Scholar Citation Index, for those of you who care, over 7,000, so a highly cited scientist. Two books, one that's already come out several years ago. Maps of Meaning, The Architecture of Belief, and one that is forthcoming. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that. We'll see. The 12 most valuable things everyone should know. I really want to know what those 12 things are. How you doing, Jordan?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. As you know, I'm quite active on social media, and a few weeks ago, I started receiving, endless alerts from people saying, "Oh, you and this gentleman, Jordan Peterson," and I must admit, I hadn't heard of you at that point. Eventually, of course, I found out who you were. Everybody was saying we need to speak, and so I was delighted when you reached out. And so I'm really, really glad that we're having this conversation. I thought we would maybe start with, I guess, what puts you on the map, so to speak, in the context of what we're going to talk about today. This bill C-16. Tell us what happened. Tell us how you got into hot waters, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, I've had a number of people in my clinical practice over the last few years whose lives have been seriously disrupted by politically correct activity in the workplace, I would say. And I have a number of other people in my social network who keep me apprised of various goings on in the media on political issues in general, not specifically necessarily about political correctness, although that often comes up. And I got two emails last week, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I guess now, one on Bill C-16 and then one on the University of Toronto's HR department's decision to make anti-racism and anti-bias training mandatory for the HR staff. And you mentioned the book, the second book that I have coming out. I've been writing to some degree about political events in that book. And so I've been preoccupied with this sort of thing very actively for the last year, but all of my fundamental line of research as well, by the way, is on authoritarianism and ideology and the deep roots of ideological belief and the role that belief plays in structuring people's emotions and motivations. So I have a number of reasons for being interested in this, but the proximal one was being informed about Bill C-16 and the University of Toronto HR department's plans. And I don't know, it's just I just thought that it was bothering me enough that I needed to articulate what I thought. So I don't like the feeling of having of being stifled in my expression. And I thought, well, I've got to sort this out. And of course, a big part of the way that people think is by talking. And I thought, well, I'll try to formalize an argument and I'll post it. And that way I can formalize the argument, see what I have to say. William James once said, how do I know what I think before I write it down? And of course, speaking and writing are forms of thinking. And so I made these videos and well then, they got a lot of attention, to say the least. Which was quite interesting to me because, when the chairman of the psych department called me in a while back to remind me that I was responsible for following the University of Toronto's internal policies and the law, one of the things that she pointed out was that I brought this on myself, so to speak. And, fundamentally, that's rubbish. This video that I produced, or the couple of videos I produced, wouldn't have got the attention they got. And unless something was in the air, there's a context surrounding this. And the thoughts that I articulated struck a chord. And, the chord they struck differed with different people, right? It struck a particular kind of chord among the radical right, among the center right, among the center left, and among the radical left. But it attracted an insane amount of attention. And that's
Before
because there's a problem.
we get into the specifics of Bill C-16, have there been any either covert or manifest repercussions that have arisen at the University of Toronto as a function of you having produced these videos?
I would say the University of Toronto has responded in a reasonable and predictable manner. And I would say predictable in that because there is controversy surrounding this, it's sort of incumbent on them as a responsible bureaucracy to remind me of my duties. I would say that having said that, I would also say that, you know, I'm very grateful for my affiliation with the University of Toronto, and the institution has been continually good to me in every possible way. So apart from a written reminder that I'm to comply with the relevant policies and laws, there hasn't been any real response.
What are those policies and laws, and how much you have skirted at the boundaries of those laws from their perspective?
Well, that's where I suppose some debate still exists, because they wrote me in the first paragraph of the letter, they described what I had said, and I don't think they got what I said I don't think they represented it very accurately. They made some comments about my comments about, let's say, the biological determination of gender identity, and I think that they misquoted me. But it hasn't really got to the level of specifics beyond that.
Got it.
I think they're waiting, you know, they're intelligently waiting in the background, probably hoping this will all just go away. But it's not going to just go away. So
speaking of biological, the biological roots of identity, here's a quote from my book, The Consuming Instinct, because at one point I only watched the first part of your three-part series, which I highly recommend people to go check it out. At least part one. I've yet to see parts two and three. At one point, you're talking about this, but you know, the biological bases of gender identity, and something that you said reminded me of something that I wrote way back in 2011. So let me read it to you. So some theorists propose that heterosexuality is an imposed norm. In other words, it is argued that heterosexuality should not be construed as an innate orientation. Interestingly, when it comes to a homosexual orientation, many gay lobbyists posit that they were born with their same-sex preference. Hence, by amalgamating these two premises, one ends up with the, quote, facts that heterosexuality is not innate, but homosexuality is. This is indeed quite an extraordinary worldview for a sexually reproducing species.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, look, I mean, so one of the things that I should make clear in the course of this discussion is what this argument is about and what it's not about. And that's not a simple thing to do. And I mean, that's also partly the utility of having these sorts of discussions in a public forum. I mean, I have been severely criticized for my videos. And I don't mean that in a defensive way. I mean that in a positive way. And here's what's positive about it. First of all, I have four or five people who are very, very alert and together and careful watching every move I make. And every time I make a video, we have a discussion and they tell me in painful detail everything they think I did wrong. Poor emotional expression, unclear motivation, unclear argumentation, failure to define the points properly, etc. They're raking me over the coals, and they're very good at it. And I'm very thankful for that, because I'm trying to get the damn argument straight. And then the public response has had the same effect. You know, people on the left have accused me of, or even pointed out, that I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and that we shouldn't forget about all the positive things left-oriented political movement has done over the last 50 years. And, you know, people on the radical right are trying to, what would you say, they're trying to incorporate or identify me perhaps as one of their acolytes, or one of their a person who holds that kind of worldview. And so I have to be very careful to differentiate that all out. And but as a consequence of all that, I am getting what the central arguments are clearer. And here's what I think's wrong with Bill C-16, and also with the rhetoric, the rhetorical context from within which it emerged, which is very well documented on the Ontario Human Rights Commission website, which seems to have an undue influence over Canadian legislation at the provincial and federal level. Okay, so here's the propositions. This is the central point. So let's say there's a central monster, and then there's sort of a bunch of peripheral monsters around the fringe, and they get less dangerous as you go farther and farther away from the central monster. And so the first issue is, well, what's the central monster? And I'm having a bit of difficulty deciding that, because I think there's two. One of them is the politically correct game, which is something that we can talk about, which is this biased, it's a biased algorithm that politically correct people use to organize the world and to bolster their emotional well-being. That's one monster. And then the other monster is one that's more probably philosophical and legislative, and I think it's the worst one, so I'm going to start with it. All right, so let's take the issue of free speech. Now, free speech is not precisely the right to say whatever you want, although it is that. That's a careless characterization of something fundamental. Okay, so what free speech is the right and maybe the obligation to conduct discourse in a manner that's aimed at addressing and solving serious problems. Okay, so we might say, our society is made up of people who differ for all sorts of reasons in their viewpoints, but we have to live together and cooperate and compete in a hopefully sustainable and nonviolent manner. And there are mechanisms that allow that to occur. And the most fundamental mechanism that allows that to occur is discourse. And discourse has to be free, because discourse is the major way that we solve our problems without fighting. And the reason that discourse helps us solve our problems is because, first of all, we can articulate our being in a manner that other people can begin to understand, and they can object to that, and then we can clarify what the problem is, and then we can start to talk about solutions. And then if we come up with a good problem statement, here's a problem, this needs to be addressed, and then we can articulate a solution, and we can negotiate about that. That means we can all get behind the solution, and we can move forward with solving problems, and we don't have to devolve into conflict. And so the alternative to discourse is conflict, outright physical conflict. It's for that reason that Alfred North Whitehead said that the purpose of thinking is so that we can let our ideas die instead of us dying. Right. Yeah. It's a major league statement. That
I would say, just to interject, I would say that you're sort of the threshold of valuable free speech that you started off this latest segment with is a bit too stringent. I mean, free speech is about also allowing people to be idiots. Free speech is about people denying the Holocaust. I'm Jewish, and I support the right of people to deny arguably the most obvious historical fact that's ever been documented. So it's not only about providing people a mechanism to discuss important ideas. It's about nothing other than the right to express yourself short of inciting direct violence on anybody else. Everything else is allowed.
I'm not disagreeing with that at all. What I'm trying to point out is, see, I would say the central reason that society has to protect free discourse is because it is the fundamental problem-solving mechanism. And then I would say a byproduct of that is the necessity to allow people to say offensive things, foolish things, stupid things, partly because they're malevolent at times, but also partly because it's very frequently the case that when someone initially formulates an argument, and I mean, I see this in my clinical practice all the time, when you initially attempt to formulate an argument, you're going to do a very bad job of it because you haven't formulated the argument yet. And so you have to be allowed to stumble around like a moron, because it's the only way that you're ever going to trip over the truth. And, you know, if you can do that publicly, then people can comment on what you're doing and they can help you shape your arguments. Okay, so you've got the central issue, which is the problem-solving mechanism. And then you've got a peripheral issue, which is the right of people to do it badly and stupidly. Okay, then you might say, and you already brought this up, that despite that, reasonable people can agree that certain limitations on expression are necessary. And the classic example is that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And then you can have a reasonable discussion about what those limits might be. Hate speech laws are one example of that, although I happen to be on your side. I think that the introduction of hate speech laws into Canadian legislation was actually the beginning. It was one of the main moves that has set us on the road that we're on now.
And by the way, just for you to know,
yep.
We're facing a similar, not same thing as Bill 6-C16, which specifically deals with incorporating gender identity and gender expression as sort of a protected class. We have Bill 59, which has been tabled and is being discussed. I don't know exactly where it is in the process. This is specifically in the Quebec government. It deals exactly with, I think they call it in French, langage haineux, hateful speech. And of course, there's a huge debate about this because many people recognize that this is an attempt to try to protect one particular ideology from scrutiny. Nobody cares about whether we say bad things about Mormons or about the Amish or about atheists, but there is one protected group of class of people that we should never criticize their religion. And so you're exactly right that there is sort of a confluence of forces that are manifesting themselves throughout Canadian and provincial law, federal and provincial law, whether it be the Human Rights Commission's, the famous Ezra Levant case in 2006 or 8 when he was summoned because he had the audacity, I think, to print the Muhammad cartoons. So whatever it is that you're facing today, we saw the signature of the trouble ahead quite a while ago, correct?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, it's not surprising that people are concerned about issues like hate speech because speech can be hateful. But that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not it's more dangerous to allow freedom of speech that goes in that direction or to suppress and forbid it. And I think the evidence for that is clear. It's far more dangerous to suppress it. I think you actually validate it by suppressing it. And worse, you drive the acolytes of those viewpoints underground, and you don't subject them to proper public criticism. Even psychologically, the fact that people who have, let's call them pathological viewpoints, for lack of a better word, if they cannot express those freely in public, they can't benefit from criticism. And criticism doesn't just mean shut up and go away. That's not criticism. Criticism means, well, here's how we differentiate your argument into its sub-elements, and here's how we demolish it line by line. And so having done that, go back and reformulate it or ignore it, but you ignore that at your peril. If you ignore rationality and rational argument, then, well, good luck to you. You know, I mean.
You know, I had and I've mentioned this on a few occasions, but it's worth repeating. In 2010, Satoshi Kanazawa, who's an evolutionary psychologist and who was a very, very popular blogger at Psychology Today, where I also have a column, got into very, very hot waters because he had written an article summarizing someone else's research. This wasn't his own research, where the research had found that there were some racial differences, well, in terms of the preferences that people had, aesthetic preferences towards certain, black men, black women, white men, white women. And the way he had written it was somewhat bombastic and perhaps not sensitive, but this led to, you know, just an incredible tsunami of activism to try to not only get rid of him at Psychology Today, but also to, you know, revoke his tenure at the London School of Economics, a rather prestigious institution, because the argument was that he was, you know, spewing racist nonsense about, you know, beauty, you know, and so on. And I had written an article, and I was the only one who, if I may say, had the courage to do so, where my argument was that, look, purging a blogger sets a very dangerous precedent. And exactly along with what you said, if you wish to punish this guy, there's no better way to punish him than to leave his words up there. If he is truly a racist, if he truly holds grotesque views, let that serve as his ultimate punishment.
Yes.
To get rid of it, to delete it. So even from a practical perspective, if all you cared about, if you were an activist who simply wanted revenge, then you're going about it the wrong way. Never mind.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I am speaking about this in the most practical of senses.
Right.
You know, so, okay, so So now we can agree that there are certain limits that might be placed on freedom of expression, like fire, yelling fire in a crowded theater. And we can also agree that we need to debate what those are, and we have to be very careful about imposing them, because by imposing them, we risk interfering with this fundamental problem elucidating and solving mechanism. And then we risk it provoking conflict as a consequence. Okay, fine. That's fine. So now we have some impositions placed on freedom of speech, and we can debate about whether they're useful, but we can agree at least that some of them might be necessary. Ha! But then we come to Bill C-16, and more importantly, the cloud of policy rhetoric surrounding it, say on the Ontario Human Rights Commission website, which defines its context and also indicates the direction in which this kind of legislation is progressing. And that I've really been thinking about. And so I got in a lot of trouble I wouldn't say that, because a lot of trouble I didn't get into. I got into some trouble because the specific issue that elicited this argument had to do with transgenderism and the use of pronouns. The specifics for me are important, and that has to do with the discussion that you described earlier about discussion of biology and culture and its contributions to sexuality, which is something that is not sorted out at all. And also, as you also rightly pointed out, that the radical left has extremely contradictory, simultaneous viewpoints about. So to rush that into policy and to make it law, just around the issue of gender identity and sexuality and all of that, that's a mistake. But there's a bigger mistake lurking behind that. And the bigger mistake is, it's one thing to tell people what they can't say, but it is a completely different thing, an absolutely different thing, to legislate what they have to say. And that's a line that I don't think that we should cross. And that's the critical issue that lurks in with Bill C-16 and this surrounding cloud of legislation. There is the inference and the demand, I would say, not inference, the stated demand that if someone wants to be addressed a certain way because they have certain emotional requirements, I am now legally compelled to comply with that. And that's what I won't do. And the fact that it has at the moment to do with issues of transgender identity, mostly that's a red herring, except that there are also reasonable debate to be had about the whole issue of biology, sexuality, and culture, and the attempt to ram through a particular conception of that into legislation and policy far too rapidly and in a staggeringly ill-advised manner. Because, look, here's another example that goes along with yours. The transgender argument for early onset gender identity issues is that a person can be a man born in a woman's body. Okay, so we'll say man is gender identity. Well, that's obviously a biologically deterministic argument, because if you're a man born in a woman's body and you're born that way, then culture hasn't had its chance to affect your gender identity. So you can't argue on the one hand that gender identity can be biologically determined and fixed in the case of a mismatch between the identity and the biological sex, but then in all other instances, it's fluid. And, you know, the American Psychological Association, in its handbook on human sexuality, has already indicated that gender identity and sexual preference are to be regarded as fluid. Okay, but then that also, then there's another issue that comes up. So there is legislation now, and certainly a lot of activism surrounding the idea of conversion therapy. You know, and you can think of conversion therapy as having two elements. One is the conversion of people who have homosexual sexual preferences into heterosexuals. And there's a biologically deterministic argument being used by those on the left to forbid such practices. But if they're fluid, which is another claim that the radical left is making, then there's no reason that conversion therapy isn't appropriate if someone requires it. And that's the case not only for sexual preference, but also for gender identity. And so if it's fluid, there's no reason not to talk transgender people back into their, let's say, normative gender identity. So it's a complete mess. It's a complete logical mess. But I would say that, you know, if you look at the personality predictors of belief on the left side of the political spectrum, you find that people who are left-leaning are high in trait openness, which is a kind of creativity, and low in conscientiousness, particularly orderliness. And what that means to me is they're attracted to all sorts of wild ideas, and it doesn't matter to them a damn bit if they're coherent. And I do mean that.
I want to speak about this point, but before I do that, you know, what you're facing right now with the blowback regarding your position is something that I coincidentally had. I had a precursor to this in a 2014 talk that I gave at Wellesley College, which is Social Justice Warrior Central. It's the headquarters there.
Yeah.
And the talk that I had given was, I had been invited by a gentleman who runs something called the Freedom Project there, which is meant to, you know, try to promote liberalism and dialogue and not stifle things, right? And of course, I was slightly concerned that walking into the, you know, hotbed of social justice warrior, let's see how this was going to turn out. My talk was about how the thought police regulates the free exchange of ideas, which later, a few years later at the University of Ottawa, I did a broader perspective on this issue. And at the end of my talk at Wellesley, I had stayed back to talk to many of the students, and I've recounted this story, and it's exactly related to what you're going through. One of the students was concerned about my apparent rejection of the idea that professors should, at the start of class, poll every student about his or her preferred gender identity in determining how you should address them. And my position was, do you truly think that it is a optimal way to run society whereby each time people interact, they should first poll one another? So you don't think that it is a more reasonable mechanism to assume that, you know, we've evolved the mechanisms to categorize people along these binary categories from a very young age, and we don't have to be taught that mechanism. And so do you think that, for example, if we go into a gynecologist's office, where by definition the patients who are walking in certainly recognize that they're biologically female, should the receptionist not assume that they are female? Because what if the person identifies as a male? Of course, I picked this extreme case to try to push her thinking. And she said, well, but that's too extreme. I think it's not unreasonable for a professor to do this. So this idea that you're facing now, they always say that when the U.S. sneezes, Canada eventually catches a cold. So apparently Wellesley was quite prescient in being able to predict what you would face two years down the line.
Well, you bring up another point there too, which is why people should care about these sorts of discussions when they take place in the university. It's like the university is where things are going. And so if you care about where things are going, you should pay bloody close attention to what's happening in the universities, especially because the universities are training people for positions of leadership. And that is what universities do. And it's worked out really well because we have, in my estimates, between 300,000 and 3 million social justice warrior types now active in North America at all levels of every institution. And they're having their influence felt. That's absolutely for sure.
How did you come up with this estimate?
I tried to do a rough count, say, of women studies programs and social work programs and the other sort of radically left-leaning programs that are part and parcel of the modern university, and just did a rough estimate of how many students they're generating. You know, and it's a very rough estimate, but 300,000 is certainly too low, and 3 million might be too high, but it's somewhere in there. And that's a massive number of people. And then one of the things to remember is they're actually trained to be activists. And you might think, well, you know, that sounds a bit paranoid. It's like, it's not paranoid at all. All you have to do, just do it yourself. Go look up a dozen women's studies programs online, or any of the sort of gender and ethnic group studies programs, because I would say they're the worst offenders. They trumpet proudly the fact that they're basically producing social revolutionaries whose goal is to bring down the patriarchy. You know, and the question is, well, what the hell is the patriarchy? And that's another one of these small monsters that surrounds the central monster. You know, the patriarchy is culture, our culture. And say what you want about our culture, it has a negative and positive element, just like every culture always has. Compared to every other culture, it's doing pretty damn well. And so when you say you want to bring it down, when you want to destroy the patriarchy, just exactly what the hell is it that you're destroying?
Well, and if you're really concerned about women's rights and women's well-being and you want to fight the patriarchy, there are places in the world where there truly is a highly operative patriarchy
You
that
mean
is.
like Saudi Arabia?
Oh, I didn't say it. I
I
don't
did.
know. Of course, of
Okay,
course.
Saudi Arabia, our putative allies. Those people are not our allies.
Right.
And if Western feminists had the courage of their convictions, they would
But
be outraged that we do business with
who
them.
are we to judge whether stoning and the cutting off of clitoris is a good or bad thing, right? It's all morally relativist, right? I'm being
Yes, but
sarcastic.
that's well, that's exactly well, and that's where these sorts of arguments run into their own. That's where they face the consequences of their own internal contradictions. Yes, I mean the things that go on in those societies are absolutely horrifying. The idea that, you know, the constant complaints about Western rape culture in the context of no comments whatsoever on what's happening in places in Saudi Arabia is just it's patently absurd. But it also gives you some more insight into the actual motivations of the radical leftists, because when push comes to shove, they would rather pursue their destabilizing ideology than solve the problems that they're hypothetically concerned about. And I don't believe they're concerned about the damn problems anyways. I outlined what I see as the politically correct game in the third video I did, which I have to do some editing on, but which I, you know, I'm reasonably happy about. Sorry, just have to make a quick adjustment here. I'm having an equipment problem.
Okay, no problem.
There we go. There we go. So the politically correct game basically involves taking a domain of human activity, whatever it happens to be, in any corporation or any organization or any club, wherever there's numbers of people, noting that there's a distribution of success. So there are people who are relatively successful and people who are relatively unsuccessful by any axis of measurement, happiness, wealth, productivity, creativity, you name it. Deciding that those who are doing well are oppressing those who are doing not so well, and that's why they're not doing so well, identifying with the putative victims and claiming moral superiority. Well, that's the game, and that's, I would say, the second monster, you know, and the I truly believe that people who are committed to that game will do anything rather than stop playing it. And the reason they're playing it is there's two reasons: technical reasons, psychological reasons. If you have a comprehensive explanation for everything, then it decreases uncertainty and anxiety and reduces your cognitive load. And if you can use that simplifying algorithm to put yourself on the side of moral virtue, then you're constantly a good person with a minimum of effort. Yeah, well, I don't like that game. And another reason that I won't say the words that I'm being required to say is because I believe the words are products of that game, and I'm not going to play that game. I think it's a game that's dangerous beyond belief. And I do think that it's contributing in no small part to the rise of the radical right and among young people, which is a move, which is a social phenomena that's very unsettling, to say the least. Those people, I got some descriptions of the radical alt-right's viewpoint. You know, and I'm not painting everyone on the right with the same brush. I'm speaking very specifically of the neo-Nazi types on the
Sure.
alt-right. Those people, literally, they're pro-Hitler. They're so anti-Semitic that it's painful to read.
Oh,
It's the worst.
I receive a lot of their stuff. I'm one of the victims of some of their stuff, so I know all about it. I'm with you.
Well, it's very frightening to me to see young people turning in droves to that sort of viewpoint. And that's especially young men. And that's happened many times in the 20th century. And the results were not good. You know, so my dystopian viewpoint is we'll keep up what we're doing with all this radical push on the left. We'll keep generating monsters on the right. Then we'll have a nice economic crisis. And then we'll find out what trouble really is.
Right.
And so I'd rather we didn't go down that road. I think, well, how about if we discuss these things? How about we sort them out?
I hear you. I wanted to, as a clinician, I wanted to ask your opinion on a theory that I've recently been floating around. I think maybe the first time I mentioned it publicly was at my University of Ottawa lecture, which I think I had sent you a clip of. I think it was there. So somebody had asked me about, you know, what do I think has led to this sort of victimology ethos and the social justice warriors, and I love your explanation for sort of the politically correct game and the infusion of some of these clinical ideas into that dynamic. Here's another one I had, which is very much also rooted in clinical thinking. So as you probably are you familiar with Munchausen syndrome, right? So the idea of trying to seek empathy by feigning some illness because then you're a victim and oh poor you. Of course, there's also Munchausen syndrome by proxy where you extend that to somebody who's under your care. So I actually think that this victimology ethos that is so pervasive amongst the radical left and amongst the social justice warriors is a manifestation of collective Munchausen, right? I mean, I quickly learned as a social justice warrior that there is great empathetic strokes that I can get by somehow being a victim. Now, if I happen to be white and at Wellesley, maybe it's the patriarchy that's forcing me to wear makeup. Maybe it's forcing me to have a particular body ideal. Maybe I was bullied once when I was in high school. But ultimately, I know that the best way for me to get these empathy strokes is by being a victim. Now, of course, I end up turning this against the social justice warriors because in the grand game of the oppression Olympics, I actually score very high given my background, given what I've escaped from in Lebanon. And so a lot of times the social justice warriors have a very difficult time navigating through me precisely because I could always cash in chips that are so much more serious than theirs. And of course, that game is such a grotesque game because it no longer is about checking the how veridical or the veracity of the information that we're each sharing with one another. It really becomes who can play oppression poker better than the other, who's got the better oppression game. But first, so what do you think of my collective Munchausen idea?
Yeah, well, I think it is a mechanism by which people obtain unearned empathy, and as well as being one by which they display empathy without cost.
Right.
You know, I mean, there is a social psych literature on this showing that people do. If you ask people the degree to which they've been personally discriminated against, compared to the degree that their group has been discriminated against, they downplay their own personal victimization and upplay their group victimization. And I think that also gives people the opportunity to be successful as individuals and to be martyrs at the level of group identity at the same time, which is also a pretty, well, it's a low game, let's
Right.
put it that way.
Now
So.
you would so to go back to your point where you were talking about some of these psychometric properties in terms
Yeah.
of who this I find really fascinating because I've been this idea has been floating in my head and yesterday actually in sort of in preparation speaking to you I did a bit you know very cursory literature search to see if there's any psychometric scales that measure sort of the proclivity of someone to succumb to political correctness.
Okay, so let me interrupt for just
Sure.
1 minute. Yes, we have that.
That's I want because I saw in your part one,
Yep.
you allude to it. So
Yep.
is this still work in progress? Because I
Well, not
don't.
exactly.
Okay.
One of my students has produced her master's thesis on this topic, and it was awarded earlier this year. And she's now edited that down to publication form. I can give you some brief overviews of it. We found that, first of all, that okay, so I'll tell you the methodology first, okay? And I should also tell you, we've also done this for liberal and conservative belief.
Right.
And that was a different thesis. It was a PhD thesis that another of my students just completed earlier this year. So we did a psychometric analysis of the clumping together of beliefs that are associated with liberalism and conservatism. And look, the way you do that's fairly straightforward from a scientific perspective. What you do first is oversample the domain of liberal and conservative attitudes. And so you get a bunch of people out gathering, say, statements of belief that the press that are commonly regarded as falling on the liberal to conservative continuum. And you're agnostic about that. You overgather them. And what so imagine that there's a target that you're trying to hit, and what you do is you circumscribe an area that's larger than the target purposefully. And then what you do is you provide the items to thousands of people if you can do it, and you can do that online now. And you get them to indicate their agreement or disagreement with each item. And then you can subject the set of items and responses to a process called factor analysis. And what factor analysis does is show you which groups of questions are answered as a group in the same direction. So, for example, if I ask you if you're a happy person, and I ask you if you smile a lot, and I ask you if you're sad, there's going to be a very high correlation, one of them negative, between those three items. And so the factor analysis will say, look, all these items are very highly correlated. And so you can think of them as an entity. Okay, so we've identified three dimensions to liberalism versus conservatism, which I won't talk about at the moment, and two dimensions to political correctness. Now, the first news is, so we did the same thing with political correctness. We got a bunch of people, research assistants, graduate students, to say, okay, go out into the media and find a whole bunch of statements that appear to be associated with what people have been calling political correctness. Okay, so then we'll make a questionnaire. We made a questionnaire with several hundred items. We administered it to a very large number of people, and we did a factor analysis, and we got two factors. And the first factor was radical egalitarianism, which was primarily predicted by trait agreeableness, which breaks down into compassion and politeness on the positive side.
Let me stop you there. So just to predict where this is going. So the more radical egalitarian you are, the more you would score highly on the penchant for being parasitized by politically correct beliefs, correct?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. The higher you are, the higher you are in trait agreeableness, the more susceptible you are to this particular group of beliefs. Okay, and so the first factor is radical egalitarianism. But the second factor looked like left-wing authoritarianism. It was really the desire for language control. And we found some very interesting predictors of that. One of them was orderliness, which is an element of conscientiousness. And we know orderliness is a predictor of right-wing authoritarianism. But we also found that it was associated negatively with verbal cognitive ability very powerfully. I'm going to say that again.
Right.
The tendency to control language
right.
was very powerfully negatively associated with verbal cognitive ability. Right. In fact, the relationship between the negative relationship between verbal cognitive ability and the proclivity to hold viewpoints that were desirous of language control was higher than the relationship between verbal ability and academic grades. Hmm. It's an extraordinary powerful relationship. And we also found that it was predicted by psychiatric symptomatology as well.
And what are some of those symptoms?
I don't think I can go into detail about that. I'm talking to my student right now. We're trying to figure out what to do with this paper because the master's thesis is public, is a public document. I could just post the master's thesis. We've rewritten it for publication, but it's not published. Okay, so now the question is, well, do we release it before publication? And my proclivity is yes, but we haven't quite sorted that out yet. So I'm still... Her proclivity is also yes, but I think it's a very important study because it does a bunch of things. First, it shows that there is such a thing as political correctness, although it has two dimensions. It shows that the personality predictors of political correctness are not the same as the personality predictors of liberalism. Okay, so political correctness is not an extreme form of liberalism. It's its own animal. And then it discusses some very specific predictors of these two categories, one of which looks like left-wing authoritarianism. So
I should tell you that, not to bear bad news, but in doing my cursory lit search last night in preparation of today's talk, I did find one paper that, a psychometric paper that has looked at the proclivity to adhere to politically correct language, very much in line with what you said. So in case you haven't, if you don't know that paper, I should certainly send you a link to it.
I'm wondering if that was done by a colleague of mine a while back, because there is a colleague of mine who's done some work like that a while back.
Is it at University of Connecticut? I think that's where he's at.
I would love to
so
have
I'll send paper. It to you. So here's a second part to sort of, so I guess the bigger discussion here is, are there particular predictors that could help us understand who fits into the likelihood of being parasitized by political correctness
or not? Yeah, it's agreeable.
Right,
Cool
but
people.
yeah, hold on. So, and in marketing, one of the techniques that we use, but of course it's not specific to marketing, is something called a discriminant analysis, where you basically look for what are the predictors that allow me to discriminate for a person being in being a member of group A or group B. So, for example, if you're talking about whether you use my product or not, the world can be broken up into two. You use my product or you don't, or you voted for me or you didn't. So now I use a discriminant analysis to look for the best predictors that could help me know whether I should classify you in group A or B. So
We
from
basically did exactly that.
exactly.
But we
And,
didn't use a discriminant function analysis, but we used something very similar.
exactly. And so one of the ways that we could So one set of predictors that we could use is exactly what you're doing, looking at personality types. Here's another idea I had. It might seem like it's off. It might seem like it's a bit colloquial, but I think there's actually some merit to it. So I'm very curious to see what your reaction is. So I think that there is also, are you familiar in zoology with the, and this is the actual term, so you'll forgive if it's crass, the sneaky fucker strategy. Do you know what that is?
I suspect I do, yes. I think there's a kind of lizard that is, and also I think it's something that orangutans use. But anyways, let's
Well,
hear it.
yeah, so there are several, it happens across many species, typically often in fish species, but in others as well, where there are, if you like, two main phenotypes of males. One is sort of a dominant male that's very territorial, that's making sure that no other males infringe on his territory. And then there's another phenotype where males actually look like females, so that when they sort of approach this dominant male, he is tricked into sort of letting them through, and then hence the sneaky fucker strategy. Then they can get access to the females. So I've taken that idea and I've argued that male social justice warriors are ultimately pursuing some manifestation of the sneaky fucker strategy. Yeah, look at him laugh. You're laughing because you know I'm exactly right. And so basically,
Now, they wouldn't do that, would they?
are you
They
being
wouldn't do
facetious or are you
that.
being serious now? No, so basically the idea is now here's some sort of
That's
peripheral.
a nice look. That's every Seth Rogen movie has that sort of idea at its basis, right? Because the Seth Rogen movies, all those movies about guys who haven't grown up, are all about guys who use being on your side with regards to
The friend,
females as. Yeah,
the got it.
it's the friend mating strategy. Yeah,
But now
yeah.
listen to this. Here's some potential peripheral evidence, scientific evidence of this. So there's a gentleman, I think his name is Aaron Sell, if I'm not mistaken. He was a student of John Tooby and Leda Cosmides, two of the leading evolution psychologists. And I think he was the one, I hope I'm not misspeaking, who looked at physical strength and its link to the adoption or the support of particular political positions. So, for example, are you in support for of you know sort of militaristic interventions or not? And it turns out that simply your physical strength, and I think maybe the effect was more pronounced or only pronounced for men but not women. I don't remember the exact details, but just that was a predictor of how you navigate through some of these political beliefs. And so that, in a way, very much links up to the sneaky fucker strategy, because it basically says that there is a phenotype. So beyond simply your personality profile, there's a lot that can be gleaned from your phenotype, right? I mean, we know, for example, that certain markers of testosterone predict whether you're a risk taker or not. I've done some of that research myself. So do you think that there is any value to add to your personality research and how that can help us understand who is prone to political correctness or not? Add this physical, morphological element. What do you think of that?
It's an interesting idea because basically you're basically speaking about physiological markers of dominance.
Exactly.
And I would say that agreeableness sounds like a positive trait, but every trait has its virtues and faults. And the problem with agreeableness is that agreeable people are easy to push around. And they find it difficult to stand up for themselves. So you could imagine that in any given discussion about anything, in any negotiation, I'm somewhat for me and somewhat for you. And if I'm really, really agreeable, I'm more for you than I am for me. It's a marker of maternal behavior, roughly speaking. And women are higher in agreeableness than men. And that's true in Scandinavia, too, for all you people listening who think that all those sorts of things are only cultural constructs, which they most certainly are not. And the data on that is clear. So, and disagreeable people, like if you're negotiating with a disagreeable person, it's more for them than for you. And so if you go to the extremes of disagreeable, you find men in prisons.
Right.
And if you go to the extremes of agreeable, well, you find social justice warriors, roughly speaking. And so so there's a dominance element there. So the disagreeable people, more of whom are men, are going to be more dominant. It's not the only marker of dominance. But the idea that there would be an additional contributor of something like physical strength or physical presence, something like that, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to investigate. I'd have to figure out how to do that. But could do something like a body mass index. You might be able to give you an estimate of that or something like that.
Well, there are, for example, the physical strength stuff is typically done with hand grip methodology. In terms of...
Yeah, hand grip is actually a really good indicator of overall physical health, not just strength. Eh?
Right.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting idea.
Yeah. So let's see where, you know, the current conflict, if I can call it that, or the debacle or incident that you're facing, how do you see this playing out?
Okay. Well, the first thing we should note is that, you know, a lot of the journalists that I've talked to have talked to me about the backlash against my ideas. It's like, that isn't what I've experienced. Okay. What I've experienced is 98% support, 95% of which was from reasonable people. And then I would say within that group of supporters, there's a full range of political affiliation, slightly shifted to the right, but not so much as you might think. I mean, I have plenty of radical left people writing me and talking about their experiences being stifled in their freedom of expression by their compatriots, and also plenty who are concerned about premature closure of discussions surrounding human sexuality. It's not like all of this is going to be universally good for the people who are pushing it forward, except insofar as it allows them to continue to play the politically correct game. And so I wouldn't say that what I've faced is a backlash at all. What's happened instead is that it's produced a staggering burst of media activity. And that in itself is a phenomena worthy of note. Now, along with that has come a fair bit of critical commentary directed towards my hypothetical viewpoints, but I haven't taken that too personally because I think that, I think primarily that the criticisms of my viewpoints have very little to do with my actual viewpoints and a lot more with their instantaneous oversimplification into some variant of the standard PC game.
Right.
So it hasn't been a backlash. The question is, why did what I say strike such a chord? And the reason for that is there's a lot of trouble underneath the surface. Look, I mean, if you're talking to someone and you make a comment that they react to in a very emotional way, that's an indication from a psychoanalytic perspective of the existence of a complex underneath the surface. And a complex, you might regard a complex as a mass of highly emotional, undigested, and unarticulated experience demanding expression so that it can sort itself out. Well, that's the situation we're in this society, because we are pushing very hard in the radical left direction on all sorts of fronts at every level of society. And we're dangerously confusing large segments of the population who are having a difficult time articulating their perspective. And so I tossed a little seed crystal into this super saturated solution, and all of a sudden, bang, there's just noise everywhere, right? I mean, it's crazy. It was national news on CTV and CBC, and I think all the major newspapers, the national newspapers, covered it in detail. And, you know, there's been 65,000 views on the first video, and like, it's been a real explosion. The question there is, well, why? And I can tell you, it's not because of pronoun usage in relationship to transgender people. Although it would be lovely if we could oversimplify the argument to that, define me as a bigot, and make the argument disappear. Well, that's not happening. It's not disappearing.
So what do you think I mean, you're obviously somebody. I mean, I could hear it in your voice in the part one series. You know how you were angry, you were frustrated. You, as you said, you had to find a mechanism to vent some of these frustrations that were simmering in you.
No, I would say articulate.
Articulate. Fair enough.
Because look, and the reason I'm saying that, I hate to be a stickler about that, but on the radical left, people are always talking about feelings. And I was actually taken to task by one of my critics for beginning that lecture with my feelings. Because he said, well, who gives a damn about your feelings? By the way, this is a very liberal person. He described himself as the most liberal person he knew. So, but he took me to task for starting with feelings. But often a discussion starts with feelings, but it's your obligation as a citizen and a rational individual to transform those feelings into an articulated argument. And hopefully you'll have some help along the way. And that's what I was trying to do. It wasn't a matter of venting,
so
which is merely the expression of emotion.
So irrespective, yeah? let's not get caught up in the trees. Irrespective of whichever word you'd like to use, you obviously had the right personhood, the right set of personal attributes that said, look, I don't care about any blowback that I might receive. This is what I must do. And anybody who knows my work knows that I live by that ethos, right? I mean, I take on issues that are much more dangerous to my own well-being and that of my children than simply transgenderism, right? So
yes,
there are much bigger monsters out there than the activists of transgenderism. And yet I do it because my commitment to the truth, or at least as I'd like to perceive the truth to be, is more important than anything else. And therefore, my unique personhood compels me to act in the ways that I do. And same thing for you. So,
for me, it's simple. And my wife had a dream about this the other day that I'm actually going to post because I analyzed the dream about where we are in this debate. And her dream indicated that the door is still open to a peaceful solution to all of this, but that it's a lot later in the game than people think, which I also believe. To me, it's and I've talked a lot with my family about this over the last 2 weeks, because of course we just happened to go through one very long lasting crisis in our lives that we got resolved, and then I introduced all this. What I suggested to my wife was that, well, I can either have this fight now on my terms, or I can wait for 5 years and have it brought to me.
Right.
And then with regards to my chosen path, here's the issue. It's not like sometimes you have two suboptimal choices. Frying pan or fire, let's say. Okay, so I could either face the consequence of saying what I had to say, or I could face the consequences of not saying what I had to say. Well, in my estimation, the medium to long-term consequences for me and for whatever broader social community I can influence, the medium to long-term consequences for me in that community of me not speaking are so much worse than the consequences of me speaking that it's a straightforward choice. I picked what I regard as the route of peace and truth. And now I'm not saying that I'm a stellar and sinless advocate of peace and truth, because that's an archetypal ideal and not a human being. But I have oriented myself for decades towards articulating my thoughts as carefully as I possibly can. And here's something interesting. This is something to think about. So I've been practicing that for 35 years and have given thousands of lectures. But more importantly, when I lecture, I feel in an embodied sense every word I say. And my primary goal is to speak in a manner that keeps me firmly set on my foundation. That's my primary goal. And I do that in every element of my life. And so I've practiced that for 3 decades. I've given thousands of lectures with lots of feedback, and I'm good at it. And over the last 2 weeks, while I've been producing these videos, I have 4 or 5 people who are painstakingly examining everything I say and criticizing me. And maybe I'll negotiate my way through the mess.
Let me just close with that.
If I have to be that careful in my speech, when I'm responding to what is, after all, as of yet unpassed legislation, what hope does the average person have to express their opinions without persecution?
So do you feel, so when I started my question, when I was talking about sort of my whatever courage I try to bring to the table and that you bring, that requires some, you know, unique personality types to be able to go against the herd, to speak to the truth unencumbered by political correctness or herd mentality. But of course, most people, regrettably, don't share those attributes. Now, do you think, though, that by someone like you standing up and someone like me standing up, it could at some point catapult all the people who are hiding in the trenches, afraid to come out, to sort of come out, and then this will create the necessary domino? Sure. I guess if we didn't believe it, then we wouldn't be doing what we're doing, right?
I think the evidence for that is clear. I mean, you have tens of thousands of people watching your lectures. Like, you have quite a presence online. It's very impressive. So, I mean, it's not like you're a voice crying in the wilderness, man. You've got power sitting there behind your camera. It's quite remarkable. And so YouTube is a remarkable technology. And, you know, and maybe it's where freedom of speech exists at the moment.
Right. Except when they demonetize my YouTube clips because I've said some word that they don't like. But yeah, other than
that. Well, that's appalling. That's appalling.
Right.
And hopefully the sorts of things that we're talking about will help sort that out in a productive manner.
Well, you know, I'm hoping that at some point, this is an idea, this is the first time that I mentioned it, but at some point I would love to hold a symposium where I bring in voices that are, you know, engaged in the discussion on free speech, whether it be folks like you or me or someone like, I don't know if you know, do you know who Greg Lukianoff is?
I'm afraid I don't.
He was a guest actually on my show. He's the director of FIRE, Foundation of Individual Rights in Education. They basically...
Yeah, I do know the organization.
Right, so they monitor violations of the First Amendment on campus. And so I think there's all sorts of really interesting people using their own areas of expertise and their own tools that are now coming out of the woodwork, so to speak, to try to set the ship straight.
I think so too. Well, and I think it's reasonable, given what you just said too, to also assure your listeners that don't underestimate the power of your own speech.
Yes.
Like, you have to get your act together and speak truthfully. That doesn't mean you have to assume that what you're saying is correct. Those are not the same thing. What you're saying is not correct in any ultimate sense, except insofar as you're imbued by the spirit of truth when you're speaking it. I mean, you can stumble around and speak badly, but if it's genuine, if it's a genuine attempt to articulate the truth, it has unstoppable power. And I would say that's the fundamental axiom of Western civilization. The fundamental axiom of Western civilization is that there is nothing more powerful than spoken truth. And I believe that. I firmly believe that.
Amen, brother.
Yes, exactly.
I like that very much. Are there any projects, because we have to wrap it up soon, regrettably, are there any projects that you would like to promote that you're working on? I guess your forthcoming book, maybe you want to briefly talk about that, or anything else that you'd like to promote that's not yet available for public consumption?
Well, I did make a comment about our work on politics, which I'm going to try to make accessible as soon as I can figure out how to do that. The book that I'm writing, it's going to be published by Penguin Random House, and it was what would you call, inspired by a Quora commentary I wrote several years ago. I presume young person wrote in and asked for a list of the most important things everyone should know. So I wrote a list of 43 rules, and which attracted a lot of attention on Quora by Quora standards. It would have been in the top 0.1% of answers, something like that, maybe even higher in the rankings. And then I was contacted by a book agent to write something more public about what I've been talking about in Maps of Meaning. One thing I would recommend, and so I'm doing that with this book with Penguin Random House. I've selected 12 of the rules and have turned them into essays. One of them, for example, is don't bother children when they're skateboarding. And it's an analysis in some sense of the attack on masculine virtue that's highly characteristic of our current society. Another one is tell the truth, or at least don't lie. Another one is pay attention, listen to people as if they might know something you don't, which is a very useful skill to be able to develop. And so I've been working on that for quite a long time. And the book is it's in a very advanced form, and it'll be coming out sometime in the next year. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. But I also would recommend people who are watching this, like my book, Maps of Meaning, it's a very difficult book. There's a variety of reasons for that, because what I was trying to understand the role that belief systems played in emotion, in regulating people's emotions. It's a big topic. And that took me deep into religious ideas, because the most fundamental ideas that people have are religious, whether they know it or not, because an idea is religious because it's fundamental. And I didn't really understand that till I got deep into a psychological analysis of belief. But I would very much recommend Maps of Meaning, or at least the lectures that are associated with it, for people who are really interested in sorting this out, because it's an analysis of the deepest structures of our society. And it's in that analysis that I came to realize, well, let me give you an example. Here's one example. So in Christianity, the ultimate ideal in Christianity is the logos, right? And logos is embodied in the figure of Christ. You strip this of the ideas that you normally bring to bear on a discussion about religious issues. Christ is the Western world's formulation of the ideal man. Now, you can debate about whether that exists, but only insofar as you would ever debate whether an ideal exists. Well, an ideal exists and it doesn't exist. So the ideal of the ideal man exists. And you might say, well, it's up to men and to manifest that ideal in their life. That's their highest calling. So what are the central elements of that ideal? Well, the central element of the logos ideal is truthful speech. So one Christian presupposition, for example, is that the logos existed at the beginning of time. That was the word of God. Okay, and it was the logos that extracted out the order that we live in from chaos. And that's a profound idea. So the idea is that carefully articulated truthful speech transforms chaos into habitable order. Well, that's the fundamental idea that's expressed at the beginning of Genesis. And then the idea that develops out of that over the course of Western civilization is that the highest calling of every individual is to utter their articulated truth in a manner that keeps chaos and order properly balanced. Now, and there's one more corollary to that, which is a wonderful corollary. You can make a strong case that the domains of chaos and order are the most fundamental domains that human beings inhabit. It's kind of like explored territory and unexplored territory. So explored territory would be order and unexplored territory would be chaos. Now, if you're just in explored territory, well, then you already know everything and you're bored. And if you're way the hell out there, drop naked into the jungle in explored territory, then, or unexplored territory, then you're terrified. Okay, so you don't want to be bored and you don't want to be terrified. You don't want to be stultified and you don't want to be paralyzed. You want to be in the middle. Okay, you can tell when you're in the middle. And you can tell when you're in the middle because your being is imbued by an intrinsic sense of meaning. And meaning is the biological instinct that tells you that you're properly situated on the line between explored and unexplored territory. And that's a good place to be because you have one foot in order, and so you're stable. And you have one foot in chaos, so you're exploring. And so you get the benefits of being orderly and stable with the benefits of continually updating your knowledge and your order. And you do that through clearly articulated speech. Now, this is a killer idea, like seriously, it's a killer idea, especially the idea that, you know, you're evolved. And I believe that explored and unexplored territory are the fundamental domains of existence. That's what you're evolved for. And your sense of meaning is the thing that orients you to proper position within those within those meta domains. Man, I tell you, it's a killer idea. And so you,
too bad you're not passionate when you speak. I'm being sarcastic.
So look, I would say, look, people are interested in this thing at a deep level, and I mean the deepest of levels. This is a cultural identity issue.
Right.
You know, things are falling apart in our culture because we've lost our central point of orientation.
I think if I were to summarize what you just said, and then I think we need to end it. The best way that I would summarize your last segment is just get off your chair and get engaged, right? There are important discussions and debates to be had. Regrettably, and I see this amongst my colleagues who otherwise should be engaged in these debates, they're apathetic. They think somebody else should, the onus is on somebody else to get engaged. It's messy, it's dirty, you got to get in there. Sometimes you'll get death threats, sometimes you'll get blowback as you're getting right now. But ultimately, if you want to sleep comfortably at the end of the day, feeling as though you've achieved meaning, you do that by getting engaged. And hopefully what guys like you and I are doing is hopefully triggering people or compelling them to get engaged in this battle of ideas.
Well, let me add one more thing to that. So look, here's another profound religious truth. Life is suffering. It's the fundamental Buddhist dictum. The Jews know all about it. The Christians know all about it. That's why the crucifix is the central symbol, right? Life is suffering. Okay, so fine. And that can make you resentful and it can fill you with hate, and no wonder. But here's the counter proposition. You need something to counteract the suffering of life. And what you need to counteract the suffering of life is meaning. And you need a meaning that's so profound that you say, the suffering that's a precondition for all this is worth it. It's worth it. So that makes being itself worth it. Well, you find that in the forthright articulation of truth. There's nothing more meaningful than that. And that's the antidote to suffering. Safety is not the antidote to suffering. There is no safety in life. Truth is the antidote to suffering.
So no trigger warnings, right?
No trigger warnings. No, well, yes, no trigger warnings.
Life is a trigger warning, as I say.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so you speak forth your being properly, and that orients you in a world of suffering, and that stops you from becoming resentful and hateful as well. And we don't want that. And that, you know, that's what I see happening on the radical right.
Keep speaking the truth, brother. Great job. Real pleasure talking to you. Stay on the line. I will be posting a link to your website and also to your YouTube channel so that people can watch your excellent recent series. Thank you so much, Jordan.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.